This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. From the United States to Europe and Asia, people in many parts of the world are emerging from their homes as COVID-19-related restrictions begin to ease and springtime temperatures climb. But the global pandemic took a turn for the worse in some places. India on Sunday reported more than 2,600 new cases, its biggest single-day jump. That followed record increases in neighboring Pakistan and Russia the previous day. There was also worrying news from Afghanistan, where about a third tested positive in a random test. China, which reported two new cases, is seeing a surge in visitors to tourist spots, many newly reopened after domestic travel restrictions were relaxed ahead of a five-day holiday that runs through Tuesday. Nearly 1.7 million people visited Beijing parks on the first 2 days of the holiday, and Shanghai's main tourist spots welcomed more than a million visitors, according to Chinese media. Meantime, thousands of migrants are trapped in limbo and at high risk without food, water, or shelter in deserts and at sea. This as governments close off borders and ports amid the coronavirus pandemic. Migrants have been dropped by the truckload in the Sahara Desert or bused to Mexico's desolate border with Guatemala and beyond. They're drifting in the Mediterranean Sea after European and Libyan authorities declared their ports unsafe. And about 100 Rohingya refugees from Myanmar are believed to have died in the Bay of Bengal, as country after country pushes them back out to sea. Worldwide, more than 244,000 people have died from COVID-19, and the number of confirmed cases approaches 3.5 million. This is VOA News. In the United States, more than 66,000 people have died from COVID-19 and more than 1.1 million cases have been reported. The trend is toward states beginning to relax their coronavirus lockdowns, but most are falling short of the minimum levels of testing suggested by the federal government and recommended by a variety of public health researchers. This is according to an analysis by the Associated Press. 3 months into an unprecedented public health emergency, the White House has largely resisted calls for a coordinated plan to conduct the millions of tests experts say are needed to contain the virus. With no specific guidelines, states are left to figure out what a successful testing program should be while they're simultaneously trying to reopen their battered economies. If states don't have robust testing, public health experts say they will be unable to detect outbreaks quickly enough to contain them, which could lead to more shutdowns. In many states, testing has been limited to hospitalized patients, high-risk individuals, and frontline workers, but most public health experts agree that containing the virus will require a massive expansion of testing that eventually includes millions of patients without symptoms, and that's not happening now. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden overwhelmingly won a Democratic presidential primary in the U.S. state of Kansas, conducted exclusively by mail balloting by the state party because of the coronavirus pandemic. Mr. Biden had been expected to prevail and capture a majority of the state's delegates to the Democrats' National Nominating Commission. He captured 77% of Saturday's vote. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was still in the race when the Kansas party began mailing ballots at the end of March, but he suspended his campaign and endorsed Biden. Democratic leaders originally had planned to set up polling places across the state in addition to allowing mail balloting, but they scrapped plans for in-person voting at the end of March after a statewide stay-at-home order was issued. Many Democrats hoped a smooth primary would encourage greater reliance on mail balloting in Kansas's regular primary in August and its November general election. Sunday is World Press Freedom Day, and the global human rights group Amnesty International is calling on governments around the world to prioritize public health over their own egos. Amnesty says the backlash against journalists and others who criticize their government's handling of COVID-19 is hampering efforts to tackle the virus. The group also warned that censorship of vital information related to the pandemic has become a global crisis in and of itself. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
These commissioners are doing these things deliberately to test waters, because what they had expected was that we would boycott and then they would go ahead and declare Mr. Mutharika a legitimate president.
Political parties in Malawi officially begin campaigning Sunday ahead of the upcoming July presidential election.
State security arms of government seem to operate in a world of their own. Many a time we have seen that they harass, they arrest journalists, which is very worrying. Recently, we have seen an upsurge of these arrests, especially during lockdown.
It's World Press Freedom Day Sunday.
The judiciary of Swaziland is extremely compromised too. There is enough evidence that the police force and almost all agencies of justice are actually, in the context of Swaziland, meant to mete out the opposite instead of justice.
And a political pressure group condemns the Eswatini police for arresting leaders of opposition parties and trade union activists. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The General Secretary of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, says his group is opposed to the current leadership of the electoral body to organize the upcoming July election. Eisenhower Mkaka says the party does not trust leaders at the Electoral Commission to ensure the upcoming presidential poll rerun will be credible. His remarks come after the Electoral Commission announced political parties can begin their campaign for the poll Sunday. Eisenhower Mkaka tells me that his party is undertaking an unconventional campaign strategy due to the ongoing restrictions to combat the spread of the coronavirus.
Realistically, what are your chances of wresting power from the incumbent president?
Realistically, we should be talking about 85% chance. Of course, we do understand that Mr. Peter Mutharika will not take it lying down. It's not easy. He's not going to give up power or give power to us on a silver platter. We have to wrestle it from him. He's doing his best to make sure that he stays in power. But we are employing all the strategies just to make sure that he doesn't stay in power anymore.
What is your party's position on the composition of the Electoral Commission to administer the upcoming presidential election rerun, particularly when it was clear from the president that he was not going to dissolve or sack the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission, talking about Dr. Justice Jane Ansah?
Our position is very clear. The commissioners are thugs. The commissioners are accomplices, and they should not be allowed anywhere near this presidential election. And we, as Malawi Congress Party, together with our partners, don't recognize these commissioners. Look here, if we are serious about the rule of law, we should be able to appreciate separation of powers. Now, the courts found the commissioners incompetent. Parliament found these commissioners incompetent. It is surprising that it is only Mr. Mutharika who find these commissioners competent to conduct these elections. So the long and short of it, we do not want these people anywhere near the fresh presidential election.
If your party and your backers or supporters do not want the current leadership of the Electoral Commission to organize the election, then why participate in the calendar that the Electoral Commission has sanctioned, including paving the way for official campaigning to begin Sunday?
Two things that you must understand. One, the matter is live in court, and we are actually at the moment waiting for the Supreme Court to come up with their ruling on the appeal which is before them. by the commission and Mr. Peter Mutharika. Secondly, you see, these commissioners are doing these things deliberately to taste waters, because what they had expected was that we would boycott and then they would go ahead and declare Mr. Mutharika a legitimate president. So we are aware of their dirty tactics, and our participation is not necessarily legitimizing what they are doing, but we are. It's a strategy to avoid or to prevent them from going ahead to declare Mr. Mutharika a legitimate president.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the General Secretary of the Main Opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Still in Malawi, the Public Affairs Committee, or PAC, says it had a cordial and fruitful meeting with President Arthur Peter Mutharika. The interreligious group has been working with the government, opposition and civil society groups, and other stakeholders to organize a dialogue. The objective, the group says, is to ease tensions and avoid violence in the run-up to the much-anticipated July presidential election rerun. Meanwhile, analysts say PAC's dialogue efforts could be derailed if there's no compromise about the composition of the Electoral Commission charged with implementing the upcoming poll. Robert Feary, executive director for PAC, tells me that as difficult as it appears, his group is committed to working towards peace and stability during the election period.
Yes, it's true that the Public Affairs Committee engaged the head of state basically to discuss COVID-19 issues as well as the electoral process, legal processes as well, that Malawi has faced. And as a result of that, we raised issues for the consideration of the head of state. The primary aim, of course, was to prepare for a dialogue process, which we had agreed with the concerned parties that we could resume after the court ruling. Having passed the stage of the Constitutional Court ruling, we felt that we should prepare the ground for the mediation team to re-engage the concerned parties. So one of the strategies which we developed as an organization was to ensure that we re-engage the head of state and prepare his mind on issues of COVID-19 as well as the electoral process, taking into account that the COVID-19 could be an entry point for a fresh dialogue before we go to fresh presidential elections. So basically that's what we had in mind, and therefore the meeting can be described as cordial and honest, despite these opening statements may have portrayed a picture that we did not agree, but in a number of areas, as far as I'm concerned, there were several agreements, basically emphasizing the fact that the head of state, his door for dialogue was open. And therefore, this leads us to re-engage others, namely the Malawi Congress Party, the United Transformation Party, led by Saulos Chilima, and the other one, Malawi Congress Party, led by Chakwera. So that's what we'll be doing, basically.
In your view, the prospect of a dialogue before the July elections look bright?
Basically, let me say the brightness of dialogue towards the fresh elections will really depend how we frame or we agree on the issues that will be on the agenda. At this stage, I think I would be preempting quite a lot if I predicted that the dialogue will be bright, because what we did was to prepare the ground, and therefore the dialogue and mediation team will have to re-engage the concerned parties. But let me say, the dialogue we are talking about as Public Affairs Committee is not a one-off dialogue. We are talking about a dialogue which goes beyond the fresh presidential elections. When you are dealing with issues of conflict, we go by stages. You can have conflict management, but at the end of the day, even if you have had those elections carried out, you need to undertake conflict resolution where you look at underlying issues. We are advocating for dialogue because we feel we have had legal processes following the presidential case on the stalemate 2019. Therefore, we have focused more on the electoral aspect, but we have also focused more on the legal process. What has lacked in the process is to have a political process, because though you may have the court ruling, the decisions of the courts are not necessarily in their own solving all the political problems. And therefore, we believe a lot of issues which were part and parcel causing the conflict can only be dealt with using the dialogue. In fact, some of the resolutions which we can develop in dialogue can also be, you know, part and parcel of issues that can feed into the whole electoral process as well as the legal processes.
Robert, how do you reconcile these two stark positions? The president will not fire Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, and opposition and civil society groups, on the other hand, are saying that firing her is one of their major concerns because a new Electoral Commission will organize credible presidential election rerun, and that they've lost confidence in the chief election officer to organize credible election. How do you reconcile these two in a dialogue before July election?
Well, your analysis you have provided in terms of the competing objectives between the different parties actually is a justification we use to call for dialogue when we engage the head of state. What I can say, the mechanism of dialogue is very important in the sense that the parties themselves can define the problems amongst themselves, and then an agenda can be set. And from that particular process, they can start reconciling the competing objectives. In the absence of meeting face-to-face to present issues as they see them from their perspective, it's very difficult to reconcile these competing objectives. It is therefore our conviction as an organization that only opening up and meeting face-to-face, you can reconcile these competing objectives. As an organization that is facilitating dialogue, it's very difficult to reconcile these objectives. We feel by talking, even talking about something you don't want to talk about, once you start doing that, you can start understanding different positions of the concerned parties, and the parties themselves can start establishing a solution to the competing objectives.
Robert Feary is the Executive Director for the Public Affairs Committee, or PAC. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In part two of my interview with the former Botswana president, he expresses concern about the decline of the Southern African country's democracy. He also says the administration appears to be clamping down on those with dissenting views. His remarks come after opposition groups accused the government of using the fight against the spread of the coronavirus to stifle free speech guaranteed by the Constitution. But supporters of the government reject the criticisms. They say the government has been carrying out its constitutional mandate to protect life and property and will not be deterred in its commitment to fight the disease despite the criticisms. Former President Kama tells me that accusations he is involved in plans to overthrow the government are false and yet another plan to tarnish his reputation.
Mr. President, Botswana has always remained a stable democracy, not only in the Southern African region, but the entire African continent. What is the state of democracy in Botswana at the moment?
Well, that is a very easy question to answer. The state of democracy in Botswana at the moment is very much in decline.
Mr. President, what do you say to critics who say that you appear to have something against the president and by extension his administration, and that is why they said you keep on criticizing the administration and even saying that the state of democracy is in decline in Botswana? What's your reaction to that?
We shouldn't forget how this current regime came about, how he ascended to the presidency. He was, if you remember, my vice president, chosen by me, and under our rules here, the constitution, with automatic succession, he then succeeded me. So why would there be a situation whereby someone who I had worked with, who I informed the nation show them to the nation that this is the right person to take this country forward. It was because I truly believed at the time that he was the right person. But if ever you wanted to see a change of character overnight, literally, it's what I experienced with him. And I'm not the only one saying that. Many other people have said it, and they're seeing it every day that goes by. And I just feel so bad, so guilty, in fact, and regret that decision that I made, because we're in this mess now because of that decision I made at that time. So when I talk about democracy in decline, when I think that what my predecessors did, what I tried to do, if you looked at our ratings and our rankings worldwide and on this continent, what we achieved, to see all that eroded now because of one person, it's just something which you can't just say that, no, there's a new leader now, we should just sit back, let him do what he likes. And we see everything we've tried to work for being reversed. That is the problem. And when you ask me a question like that, that's how I would answer it.
Mr. President, what is your response to critics who say that they expected you to be a statesman and advise the government or your predecessor in camera or behind closed doors instead of being vocal about it and coming out in public to criticize the administration's work?
You can only give advice if it is asked for. But on the other hand, the one thing that I've always been very careful not to do is to be accused of ruling from the grave. In other words, if there are situations of policies or new programs being introduced, and at every opportunity you have, you want to say, no, 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 I wouldn't have done it like that, I wouldn't have done it like this, that would, I think, not be appropriate. But when here we are talking about something so fundamental as to say that what we have adopted as our character, what we have adopted as our people, what is our culture from so many years back, what our democracy is founded on as a people, is being undermined. You can't just keep quiet. That is my point. Because you have to toss up. I would like to know who these critics are you're talking about anyway. But you have to toss up that if you see things going totally upside down, into reverse, you have a choice of either do you say nothing or do you sound the alarm? And there would be critics as well, on the other hand, that if you also say nothing, they would also say, but why aren't you saying something about it? And I can tell you on a daily basis, I'm receiving messages and texts and calls, people saying, can you please speak up and try to influence things coming back to what they were? But, you know, I'm one person. There's only a certain amount you can say and do. And I think that if I'm going to be judged on what I say or what I don't say, I feel that I would sleep better at night knowing that on certain occasions and on certain instances, there are times when you need to sound the alarm to say, this is not the direction this country and its people want to go.
Mr. President, before you go, what do you think should be the steps Botswana should take in order to reverse the trend of the declining democracy that you spoke about?
When you say Botswana, it's not like this decline in democracy can be attributed to the people of this country. It just comes from a small clique of people in this regime who have got the power and they are abusing it. So what they need to do is to abide by the constitution and the laws of this country, and also what is there embedded in our culture as a people and our tradition, something which I said before in this interview, that we have built up for so many years. We just need to go back to that and get away from this situation we are in now, where we are fast going back into the past of what we have seen exist in other countries on this continent way back when leaders just assumed that being in power, it was all about them and not about their people. That is what is needed.
Serete Kama, Ian Kama, is the former president of Botswana. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni.
Press freedom watchdogs say the Zimbabwean government continues to stifle the media despite promises by President Emmerson Mnangagwa to relax restrictions. The government says it is changing a much criticized media law, though journalists say regardless of the law, authorities use arrests and harassment to prevent them from doing their work. For VOA, Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Kudzanai Musengi was arrested recently as he tried to record police enforcing the lockdown rules imposed by the government to contain the coronavirus. Police said Musengi was filming them without a valid accreditation card. The Government Media Commission has said the 2019 cards, however, of which Musengi was in possession, are valid until the 2020 cards are issued. The freelance journalist says his arrest is an example of how authorities prevent journalists from doing their work.
State security, arms of government, seem to operate in a world of their own. Many a time we have seen that they harass, they arrest journalists, which is very worrying. Recently, we have seen an upsurge of these arrests, especially during lockdown.
Human rights groups have recorded at least 15 arrests of journalists since Zimbabwe's lockdown began late March. In most cases, police said the journalists were intruding in their operations. Nick Mangwana, the secretary of Zimbabwe's Minister of Information, told VOA that some of the arrests during the lockdown are a result of a misunderstanding. He says the government regards the media as part of the essential services. He added that Mnangagwa's government is ensuring that the legal environment of journalists improves.
If you check in the last 3 years, Zimbabwe is the only country that improved in accordance with Freedom House index. We have, you know, clearly in a different government, especially in the new dispensation to the previous one, in our approach to freedom of information and as well as the freedom of the media.
For years, human rights groups and advocates for free media have classified Zimbabwe as being harsh toward journalists. The government of long-time President Robert Mugabe was notorious for arresting journalists and shutting down news outlets who published work deemed critical of Mugabe and his allies or his wife, Grace. When Mnangagwa took power in November 2017, he promised to change that. But Tabani Moyo, the head of Media Institute of Southern Africa in Zimbabwe, says proposed new media laws are equally as bad as the previous ones. Most of the reforms were thrown out when the bill went before parliament, which is ruled by Mnangagwa's ZANU-PF party.
This doesn't show a government which is breaking in the past, but which is intolerant to divergent views, whereby in the press is seen as part of a contest to power and is treated as such.
Moyo said the arrests of the 15 journalists confirmed their fears that Zimbabwe's government is not in favor of press freedom. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Mark the World Press Freedom Day, here is a message from the director of VOA, Amanda Bennett.
I'm Amanda Bennett, and I'm director of Voice of America, and I'm talking to you from my home where, like most of you, I'm quarantined because of the spread of the coronavirus. The coronavirus is one event that shows us more than ever why a free press matters. There's so much bad information, so much misinformation, so much disinformation that people all around the world are depending on us to give them factual information. And because of that, we are also depending on all the brave journalists all around the world who, perhaps in places that don't enjoy a free press, are still continuing to report on the truth about coronavirus in their country. We'll be right back.
is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga, then music from our African collection. But first, in Eswatini, the People's United Democratic Movement, or PUDEMO, a banned opposition political party, has condemned what it says is a continued harassment and intimidation of political leaders and trade union activists. This after police arrested the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters of Swaziland and leader of the Swaziland Association of Teachers, or SNAT, Saturday. No reasons were given for the arrest, but political activists say the two leaders were arrested for expressing their opinions on social media platforms about the current situation in the Southern African Kingdom. Wandile Ludlu, Secretary General of PUDEMO, tells me that his party has warned it will hold the police responsible if any of the leaders were harmed while in custody.
We have just issued a statement to condemn His Majesty's police, who have been harassing journalists, trade union leaders, and political activists the couple of days, leading to the recent one in Saturday being two, one from the SNAT, National Teachers Union, together with the leader of a new party called EFF Swaziland.
Did the police say why the leaders were arrested?
Yes, the main gripe is people using social media to express themselves on various issues, including political, you know, problems and poverty. And the Prime Minister did highlight that all people who speak ill of government and the king will be dealt with, and circulate those messages in social media. So we understand this to be the crackdown on the instruction of the Prime Minister in pursuit of His Majesty's mandate.
But Wandile, some people are suggesting that perhaps their opinions expressed on social media platforms have the ability to create panic and disaffection, particularly during this case where a lot of people are scared of the ongoing spread of the coronavirus.
Well, my brother, on this case in specific terms, it has nothing to do with your fake news and things like that. These are human rights activists. These are trade union leaders who are speaking about the deficiency of policy implementations, as well as lack of service delivery, poor salaries, the harassment of communities by police and soldiers. In Swaziland, the government has been seen during this period of COVID-19 deploying soldiers and police to harass people on the streets than giving people food, clean water, and testing people. So people, when they go and express these frustrations and these realities in front of them, His Majesty responds through what they are well known of, responding by cracking down and crushing those who share a different political view to the status quo. That is the biggest challenge which perpetrates human rights violation by His Majesty, even during the era of COVID-19.
Wandile, your party warned that you will hold the police responsible if anything were to happen to the arrested leaders. How do you plan on doing that?
We understand that the police are keeping these comrades and following them from time to time. And to a great extent, police are in principle supposed to enforce the law, present suspects before courts, follow due process. But clearly, under these circumstances, there is a well-documented trend that police don't do that. Pick people, torture them, and sometimes kill them Today is 2020. We're commemorating a decade after Comrade Sipochele was killed behind bars in 2010 during the May Day, which is just a decade ago. And for a number of times, these police who were literally responsible for this have not been held accountable. So we are pulling all strings possible to build a human rights defenders network in Swaziland that will make and take initiatives of criminally charging and pursuing these police officers, even when they are retired. We'll pursue them if we have evidence that they have been responsible for illegal and inhumane activities like the killing, torturing, and maiming of political activists, human rights defenders, and trade union activists in Swaziland.
Looking at the current situation in Eswatini, do you think your plans are feasible and will work against the police?
When you fight for justice, you are pursuing a very difficult terrain, and you do not expect things to be easy. But what motivates us is knowing that justice will always prevail against evil forces. Notwithstanding that the judiciary of Swaziland is extremely compromised too, there is enough evidence that the police force and almost all agencies of justice are actually, in the context of Swaziland, meant to mete out the opposite instead of justice. But we stand very confident that tomorrow looks very bright, and the forces that are engaged in activities that are against humanity will never win. So my brother, I am quite confident that the efforts we have put so far are pushing and are shaking the powers that be. And tomorrow, as I have said, looks even far more promising. Great. So we will never despair. We will only soldier on, for we believe that truth will always triumph over evil.
Wandile Dludlu is the General Secretary of the PUDEMU. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. A prominent Ugandan lawyer says many of his fellow attorneys need financial aid to survive restrictions imposed by the government. Officials say the quarantine formed part of the measures to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Isaac Samakadi says due to the restrictions, many lawyers are unable to work. Some analysts say lawyers, unlike many Ugandans, are paid well and should be able to cope without any help. They contend that lawyers charge high fees to represent their clients, thereby allowing them to belong in the top 1% of the population. They also say public sector workers and those in the informal sector, as well as poor people, need palliatives to help cushion the effect of the pandemic more than the lawyers. But attorney Isaac Samakedi tells me that lawyers, like all Ugandans, also need financial assistance to help them cope with the prevailing conditions.
According to many lawyers who we interviewed and interfaced with before we created this fund, it was reported that by staying home for an indefinite period of time without any income, they were subjected to another pandemic of unspoken hunger, poverty, disease, hopelessness, shame, domestic violence, and many other misfortunes for which the national response to combat the coronavirus and COVID-19 disease has been woefully inadequate. So this is a self-help scheme that is member-centric and is intended to call upon fellow practicing lawyers to look within and be each brother's keeper. There has been wonderful uptake so far. Nearly $5,000 has been raised, and we have disbursed it to some of our members who are in need of urgent relief, health-wise, economically, or even for mental health services. So we have psychiatrists on board and counselors who are attending to our colleagues in need.
Isaac, some people are of the view that Ugandan lawyers are paid handsomely well, and they don't need any of such measures to keep them up, because they are at 1% of the highest earners in Uganda.
That is the traditional view of the legal profession. Unfortunately, it no longer holds true. Since the liberalization of higher education in Uganda in the early 2000s, there has been such an overwhelming increase in the number of students wishing to join law school and graduating from law school and entering the bar. Yet there has not been equivalent preparation for receiving them as well remunerated advocates. So you have an excess capacity of attorneys, almost all of them centered in the capital, working under the most incredibly, woefully inadequate working conditions, surviving hand to mouth. And this is the underbelly of the profession. This is the situation nobody has wanted to tackle for a long time, and it's a ticking time bomb. This, our fund is alive to this reality, and I think it cuts across many African countries. The working conditions of the professionals have been deteriorating for a long time.
Isaac, some people are of the view that the underprivileged in Uganda and the less fortunate should be the focus of non-governmental organizations, both local and international, as well as the government, and not those in the law profession, since those who are well-to-do can help those in the fraternity to keep their head above waters. What do you say to that?
I agree with that view at first blush, because our fund is initially seeking resources from colleagues at the bar. We haven't yet reached the stage of asking for resources outside the legal fraternity within Uganda and abroad. However, it is of some value for the local and global civil society to support this initiative, because the coronavirus COVID pandemic is both a public health and human rights issue. Resources must not be disproportionately invested in public health responses while ignoring the capacity of human rights defenders to check and watchdog government responses during this time. Dictatorships and semi-democratic regimes like Uganda and elsewhere across Africa, they love pandemics because pandemics give them a blank check to invade the national treasury, suspend human rights, and basically have arbitrary autocratic authority, something they've desired for a long time. So we need the resources to put lawyers back on the street so that they can check every agency of government involved in the justice, law and order sector to ensure that the underprivileged continue to enjoy the basic human rights that they are entitled to. Otherwise, without the foot soldiers for rule of law, the underprivileged will still get a raw deal. So it is of great value to ensure that attorneys have all they need to measure up to the martial law conditions that are in the country, in Uganda and elsewhere across the continent.
Isaac, so what will your group of lawyers in Uganda do in this fight against COVID-19, as well as trying to find ways and means to help your colleagues in the law profession in Uganda?
So our initiative is intended to achieve three immediate outcomes. Number one, to help soften the mental health and economic tolls of the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic on our colleagues who may be less resilient in the face of this crisis. Once we have our foot soldiers alive and in good health and with sufficient levels of motivation, we will seek to get them back to work. We will seek the government to classify lawyers as essential service providers who should be at work with sufficient precautionary measures so as to ensure as much as possible that the justice, law and order system continues to function normally. Because right now Uganda is under total lockdown and that is unsustainable. We can contribute to the effort to combat COVID-19 by being at work, not by staying at home.
Isaac Semakadi is a prominent Ugandan lawyer. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Three people at the German Premier Club Cologne have tested positive for coronavirus, although the training will continue as planned, according to club officials. The Bundesliga is set to become the first major football league in Europe to return to competition. Officials suggested a resumption on May 9th, but government-led decision and a restart may now be May 16th or May 23rd. On Thursday, Chancellor Angela Merkel said that any decision on if and when sports activities could resume would now be taken on Wednesday, May 6th. Meanwhile, in the United Kingdom, at a stakeholders' meeting, clubs discussed steps to resume the season. The league and club will only return to training and playing with government guidance and under expert advice after consultations with players and managers. Elsewhere, France became the first of Europe's top five leagues to abandon its season on Thursday. PSG was crowned France soccer champions. There was no trophy ceremony and there will be no parade. Also, France neighbors, Belgium and the Netherlands, have abandoned their leagues. The Dutch league froze the standings without naming a champion or relegating teams to the second tier, while Belgium intends to hand the league trophy to Club Brugge. In Africa, Guinea became the third African country to declare a premature end to their soccer season in the wake of the COVID-19 epidemic. Guinea follows on the heels of Angola and Kenya. The season, which started in October, had only reached the halfway stage and was due to be completed in June. No champions will be crowned, but the top four in the standings at the time of the league suspension will compete in next year's continental competitions, the African Champions League and the African Confederation Cup. There will be no promotion or relegation. Mauritius became the first African country to stop its season. Kenya and Angola followed, but clubs in Madagascar voted to attempt to carry on after meeting on Thursday. The Confederation of African Football have told member associations to set a May 5th deadline to reveal whether they intend to continue with their domestic programs or call an end to their respective seasons. And in boxing, WBC heavyweight champion Tyson Fury seems to have had a change of heart and now says he'll keep fighting until the age of 40. The 31-year-old fighter, who had earlier said that he is looking towards retirement, told ESPN on Thursday that he has no plans to call it quits anytime soon. He told ESPN, in his words, "I'm going to fight on until I'm 40 years old." He said he has been thinking about it and there isn't much else to do anyway. Fury added that he doesn't see anyone out there that can challenge him. The heavyweight champion, while contractually obligated to hold a third fight against Deontay Wilder, has recently been exploring the possibility of facing Anthony Joshua for the ever-elusive undisputed heavyweight title. Some have alleged the fight might be in the Middle East, but Fury will still have to deal with Wilder first, one way or the other. Meanwhile, Mike Tyson, the former heavyweight champion of the world, released a video of his workout. The 53-year-old said he was going to start working out again and doing some boxing training in preparation for some possible charity exhibition bouts. He may or may not do any exhibitions, but he's working out. According to the video, Mike Tyson still looks terrifying, hitting the pods. The power is still there, it seems, and yes, the speed too. And that's it for this edition of Northern Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
mwenyewe siku mwache pengine uniachewe alimwani unanipenda fikiri tututaishi kwenye dunia siku mwache pengine uniachewe nina jiko we jiko langu kama mboni ya macho yangu nitakulinda mpenzi wangu we jiko langu kama mboni ya macho yangu
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the child of an elephant will not be a dwarf. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.